Hi, and welcome to Communicating Climate Change, a podcast dedicated to helping you do exactly that. I'm Dickon, and I'll be your host as we dig deep into the best practices and the worst offences, always looking for ways to help you and me improve our abilities to engage, empower, and ultimately activate audiences on climate-related issues. This episode features a conversation with investigative journalist Tsira Gvasalia. It was recorded in person in Tbilisi, Georgia, in August 2024 at the ENOST Conference for Climate Journalism. It's one of four episodes dedicated to issues complicating climate communication in Eastern Europe and the Caucasus region. Tsira is an investigative and science journalist based in Tbilisi, Georgia. She's the founder of Cactus Media, a bilingual news platform raising awareness about the interconnection of human health and environmental pollution. Since 2010, she's worked for a number of Georgian print and online media organizations while also contributing to international outlets too. With a focus on investigating corruption connected to natural resource extraction and environmental pollution in Georgia, as well as Russian business interests in precious metal mining across the region, Tsira works to shed light on the lack of climate, environment, and health data in post-Soviet countries, stressing the importance of improving data collection and evidence-based decision-making processes. Amongst other things, Tsira and I discussed the challenges facing climate journalists living under rising authoritarianism, the interconnectedness of climate change and the rest of our lives, and the identity crises facing post-Soviet countries like Georgia as they try to establish who they are and what they stand for. Anyway, let's get on with it. This is Communicating Climate Change with Tsira Gvasalia.
From your perspective, how can communication best contribute in humanity's response to the climate crisis?
I think we have to consider the psychology in this communication, like in anything else, to narrow it down to a person's perspective and person's experience, or also how it affects person's life, everyday life, for example. We go out, for example, it's too hot. We have, for example, cardiovascular problems, or our parents or our grandparents have this kind of problem, then it becomes our problem. We don't have to separate it from anything else because it's connected to everything. It's connected to a culture, it's connected to health, it's connected to energy, it's connected to economy. It's connected to how much we spent on our monthly bills. I'm sure that it will affect our daily lives more and more in the future. Yeah, so we have to humanize it, like every story that we do. It's not as easy because, for example, if there is the topic of, for example, cancer, we can find person who has a cancer or who is a relative of person who has a cancer, and that's quite relatable. But how we humanize the climate story? I think we should approach this issue of how we communicate it to people.
For those, including myself, who aren't really clued up on the society, culture, and government in Georgia, could you give us a brief introduction?
Georgia is a small country with about 3,700,000 and a little bit more people. It's a post-Soviet country which has undergone through a lot of hard periods, including the economic transition when the Soviet Union collapsed and every country had to find their own way. Of course, naturally, there was hard times. We nearly had nothing in our childhood, no food, no electricity. We have survived, but I think that lots of Soviet countries have not really found their real identity, who they are really, because in the past they were part of a big system, which was Soviet Union, which was centralized and which was controlled by Moscow. But now, as you become independent, you have to create yourself. How you see yourself is very important. Thus, you can attract other people, make your country interesting for others, integrate yourself into the rest of the society. We had some good period in Georgia when there was also economic growth and the pro-Western government, but because of the lack of experience in politics, it's quite quickly became authoritarian leadership that lost its popularity. And then we now at the moment we are in a situation when we have this so-called Russian agent law, when all the media and NGO communities are under threat. There are very good young people, for example, who protested against this Russian law. And I think we have very good hope on those generations that really did not have any leaders. They organized themselves and they said that they don't want to go to Russian direction. They are very clear that Georgia's future is European, as it has been. The prior slogan was back to our home, which is Europe. Our culture is really old. We have, for example, the very big history of making wine, gold production, and so on and so forth. So it's like a country of old civilization, but has to find its new identity for the 21st century. It's not there yet.
How would you describe the attitudes to climate change that exist in the country?
When I started being a journalist more than 10 years ago, when I started working for online media, I was pitching environmental stories, not so climate, because I wasn't aware and educated in climate direction by that time. And they would always say that we are not interested in environment, we are interested in politics. I mean, what does it mean to be interested in politics? Because everything is politics. I mean, energy is politics, health is politics, everything else we have talked about, which is connected to climate. So it's about policy. I mean, we have to cover the policy of certain topics that the country is functioning on, and the politicians have to serve too. Because if the politician is not coming out with some ideas of how to solve the problem, he or she is not a good politician. So it was more concentrated on, I think, covering politicians, like people, rather than the policies, because they didn't have idea about what they are going to do with certain things like air pollution, like healthcare, and everything else like the post-Soviet country had. So it was more the journalism about politicians. Our journalistic culture has to switch to covering not politicians, but policies. We had recently met some politicians and asked them what they think about climate change and energy issues. Are they aware of the documents that exist in this direction in Georgia? And most of them didn't know, were not aware of, which means that they are not taking seriously the topics. So we have that, for example, we have a document which is not approved yet, but there is a draft of climate and energy action plan. But most of the politicians had not read the document. They didn't know what it was about, what kind of problems it had. And we were trying to introduce it to them. I hope that the politicians will change their mind and they tried really to integrate and realize that it's connected to energy, economy, everyday lives, and even what will be your bill next year.
Do regular Georgians understand this?
No, I don't think so. That's why I think that the climate communication is very important. We just don't have to separate it and say that this is climate change issue. We have to connect it with everything. For example, one of our colleagues said that in the editorial staff, they injected a person who is specialized in climate change. And she was telling everyone, for example, person from culture, person from economy, person from, I don't know, anywhere, that how it is connected to climate change. So she or he changed their perspective on climate change. So this is not climate change, but this is like how climate change is connected to health. So let's don't package it like climate change, but package it like how heat waves will have impact on people who have cardiovascular diseases.
How does the rising authoritarianism in Georgia work to curb the freedom to talk about climate change?
Of course, I mean, the authoritarian regime doesn't serve any good to anyone or anything. I'm sure that it will be a big obstacle for journalists and for me, like everyone else. But I also have to mention that there was a Chauvet disaster in Georgia, for those who don't know, your listeners, for example, that there was a big glacial landslide in Georgia, which killed 33 people, and it was like nationwide disaster, and it was highly politicized. It was like emergency situation. And I published a story about it both on my Cactus platform and also shared it on Radio Liberty. It was very extremely popular, which means that people are concerned about climate change because we raised several issues. For example, that the glaciers are not only glaciers, beautiful things, but they are the sources of freshwater, and they are sources of our future. They are also sources of, for example, tourism. It doesn't mean that people are not interested, but you have to show them. We had beautiful pictures. We had, for example, what the Swiss government is doing, for example, where like the skiing is part of tourism and part of the economy of the country, that they are covering the glaciers. So we had also this example, the best practice, how it's done somewhere else. So it had many components, which made it popular.
Could you tell me about the Russian law?
Russian law is quite an unfortunate thing for Georgia because it's like more or less the copy of what was adopted in Russia in 2012. If you say it in short, how it touched me, for example, you have to register. If you are an NGO or media organization that gets more than 20% of its income from foreign forces called like the donor from outside Georgia, UK, EU and US, if you get funds from these sources or from these governments, then you are considered as a foreign agent or the person who is making their interest in your country, which is not true because we are covering our own issues and no donor has ever told us how to behave, what to write about. So this law is, of course, a big obstacle. You have to close the accounts. For example, it's dangerous to have some money on your account because it may be blocked. So technically, it made many problems. Some of the organizations have to create new organizations to sustain themselves for some time before the fine comes to you. But if you don't register, like the forced registration, it's a very bad thing.
Have you encountered censorship or intimidation or other forms of pressure when covering environmental topics?
I wouldn't say I had it directly or something that I felt, but I don't exclude that there was something that I did not realize or didn't feel directly, but it happened. For example, I would say that my personal Facebook page was disabled, and some people think that it may be because I was covering very actively this Shovi disaster and was criticizing National Agency of Environment, and they were reading everything. And I am covering air pollution in Tbilisi, which is terrible, and how it's monitored, how these technologies are maintained, how the website is maintained about air pollution in Georgia. So I may have been target for these trolls, for example, because Cactus was also popular during COVID-19 because I'm also covering health issues, and Cactus was translating and introducing international source to Georgian media, and also how WHO was reacting to COVID-19, or how FDA, American Food and Drug Administration, was saying something about new vaccines and all these production things that was happening worldwide. So I was really a source for this. And even TVs and other media would take material from Cactus. So from that trust that I built, I may have been some kind of discomfort for this government. So my answer to your question may be yes, I have.
And have you encountered a reluctance from locals when discussing environmental impacts in certain regions?
Yes.
And if so, how do you overcome these kinds of barriers to gather and share their stories?
Yes, for example, I've been covering gold mining, the only gold mining site in Georgia, which was like a Soviet enterprise. Then it was acquired, unfortunately, by Russian businessmen. And there is this very dire environmental situation because the pollution. And I even had a cross-border project with ENOST, with Armenian colleagues. We wrote a project called Golden Dust. The roads, the trees, plants are covered with really golden dust because copper and gold is extracted from the land, and while it's transported, it's not covered. The tracks are not covered, and this particular place is very polluted. And I had covered it from different perspectives, also from scientific, because there were German scientists who were studying soil pollution and also the transmission of soil pollution to the food chain. And when I went to this village, finally, I said that, introduced myself as a journalist and said that, what do you think about this? And suddenly all of them became quiet and said that, we are not going to say anything because most of our family members are working in this company and this is the only place that we can work. So they were silent. So nothing changes, actually. And since then, I was there actually 2 months ago, and there was a public hearing of a waste dump for the company, and actually nothing had changed because everything was the same as 13 years ago, unfortunately. It's also very well connected to the government, this company. There is also this scheme of when you have big business in the country, you contribute some money to ruling party. You give 20,000, 50,000. And it's like a good deal between the government and the company. The company is continuing to get the precious metals, but the environment is the same, the pollution is the same, they don't water the roads, the poverty is the same, the houses are the same, everything is the same, unfortunately. But it's not fair, of course.
Given the unique political and social landscape of post-Soviet countries, how does climate communication differ in Georgia compared to Western nations?
In Georgia, as I said, climate change and environmental issues coverage was considered as a luxury. And even ministers themselves would say that it's a matter of luxury. I have heard that it's like luxury for us. We cannot think about air pollution. We cannot think about technical provision of the cars because we are poor. It's a totally wrong attitude. It's not like a luxury because, for example, I requested information about the respiratory diseases recently, and I saw that for the last 5 years there has been an increase of the respiratory diseases in Tbilisi. And I'm quite sure that it's also connected to air pollution. So it's not like a luxury topic, it's a topic of very importance. So it's not that it's a luxury to think about the environment. No, because if you don't spend money on the cars are monitored or how the air is monitored, then you have to spend it on health. So it's not even prevention of the diseases. It's like the treatment of the disease, which always more expensive than the prevention.
What strategies have you found effective in communicating the urgency of climate change and environmental degradation to a public that may not prioritize these issues?
Yeah, unfortunately, we had this Soviet disaster, as I said, and it was really big and there were tourists and it became international story. But because of this, it was quite easy to communicate this glacier story with people. Of course, I also don't want such things to happen for my articles to be popular, of course, but I think I have to continue communicating, but finding creative ways of how to communicate it with people. That's why I'm thinking that if you cover COP29, which will happen very soon in Baku, for example, and it's also quite funny that it will happen in a country which is the exporter of fossil fuel gas, and to Georgia as well. We mostly buy gas from Azerbaijan. So, we have to cover it like this, at least. We have to explain it to people in very simple terms. It doesn't mean that we have to oversimplify, make it superficial. The other attitude also is not working. To talk about the UN reports, it's boring for most people. But it doesn't mean that the article doesn't have to be the on the ground. You can stylize the article in a way that everyone, every person relates himself or herself to that topic. But then you could include the data in the article in the middle, for example. You have to connect climate storage, everything.
How do disinformation campaigns affect environmental reporting in Georgia? Can you discuss any specific instances where such influence has shaped public opinion or policy?
I can comment about Georgian government's narrative after Chauvet disaster, which was that they said, okay, climate change is happening everywhere, like in Georgia. And they came up with this message. How they tried to cope with this emergency situation. They said that, okay, this terrible disaster has happened, but it's happening everywhere. It's not our fault. But of course, they didn't say that they could, for example, have more weather forecasting infrastructure to strengthen the scientific institutions which are weak, to, for example, install more, for example, alert systems near glaciers or near landslide-prone areas, on things like that, something that they should have done. They avoided those responsibilities, but they said that, you know, climate change is happening everywhere, including in Georgia. Prime Minister, high officials, like, for example, the head of Parliamentary Committee of Environment and Natural Resources. And when I noticed that people were repeating it, I saw it as like a part of a state government message.
Access to reliable data is often a fundamental part of climate communication efforts. How do you find climate information when local authorities may withhold it?
Of course, in countries like Georgia, we don't have enough infrastructure, we don't have enough science. We have nothing actually to gather good quality data in anything, in water, in air, in environment, in climate, in forecast, and so on and so forth. But what do we have is like some kinds of documents. For example, we have climate communication documents. And as a journalist, you can read it. I mean, we have four such documents, and really any journalist knows about it. I mean, it's like also laziness among journalists. They don't know what is existing on the national level. There are these documents. You can go back to these documents. It's written by scientists. Of course, they say that there is data limitation. Data limitation is a problem everywhere, in almost every research that I read or translate, because there is no perfect data. There may be in some countries, rich countries, which have the possibilities to gather data like daily, annual, monthly, annually, and so on and so forth, and put it into models. But even if you don't have data, this is also a story that you don't have enough data, and you have to say it. But you don't have data, and that's why you are not able to, for example, forecast weather after 1 month. The fact that you don't have good data doesn't mean that you don't have to write about it. Read all the material that is available in your country. You request it, you find it on open sources, on the ministry's websites, and see what is there. And there is something always there. And then from that, you come up with scientists who has worked on this or that certain topic and ask them, what's the limitation of this data? And you report.
What's the single most important aspect of communication that we should be paying attention to in our communication endeavors?
We don't have to separate it from other topics. We have to connect it to as much topics as possible. We have to connect it to everything. We don't have to say this is a totally different topic. It is not. It's connected to every aspect of our life.
What's the biggest mistake that you see communicators make when attempting to engage the public on climate change issues?
Yeah, I think we don't have to make it too scientific. We don't have to present it as something that is far away, because many people mentioned that climate change is happening in the UN or, I don't know, in the coastal countries or somewhere else. It's happening everywhere. We can go to, for example, NASA website or multiple brilliant Facebook pages when they show in many ways and in beautiful ways how the, for example, daily, monthly, and annual temperature is rising. We see those figures. So we can present them and say that this is really happening, not somewhere else, but in our environment, in our city, in our village. But it affects us differently. For example, if you live in the city, the heat wave will hit you. If you live in the village where there is landslide, the landslide will hit you. This news avoidance is like also understandable. And we have to accept it as journalists that this is happening. In this case, we offer a solution. For example, when you pose a problem that there is, I don't know, something, heat wave, what's the out, the way out of that? Or how do you find the temporary solution and what's the long-term solution to that? Or how can we nudge the government to do more and so on and so forth? We don't have to make scary stories on the one hand about climate change, but also offer some solutions.
I had a fascinating time talking with Zira. But what in particular stuck with you from our conversation? What will you take from it and apply to your own work? For me, it was her emphasis on humanising news stories. It took me back to my conversation with Catherine Dunn, who explained that a good news story is someone doing something because. How many missed opportunities have passed us by? How many reports or conversations or social media posts have failed to bring that human element to the table? Then, it's Tsira's low bar for integrating climate into other topics. It reminded me of how, in business contexts, there's often a discussion about not letting sustainability be an add-on, but rather an integrated part of other business functions. Finance? That's sustainability. Supply chain? That's sustainability. It all connects. This seems to be the same kind of thinking, and I really, really dig it. Finally, I'm left thinking about the fact that this episode will be published on October 28th, 2 days after the upcoming Georgian elections, in what has been widely dubbed the most important poll since the country's independence. Essentially, it will determine Georgia's alignment with either Europe or Russia, a result that will likely have major consequences for the region. People were already talking about revolution back in August in Tbilisi. I guess by the time this episode goes live, we'll have a much clearer picture of what the future holds. So that's what I'll be taking with me. But how about you? What did you hear? What will you be incorporating into your communications endeavours? Thanks to Tsira Gosalia for sharing her time and insight with the show. It was great. You can find links to some relevant resources in the show notes. Thanks also to you for listening to Communicating Climate Change. If you enjoyed this episode, why not leave it a rating or a review? Your feedback not only helps to shine a light on the guests and themes that resonate with you the most, but also boosts visibility, meaning the series reaches more people, expanding the community, and driving the conversation forward. You can find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts, or by subscribing, so you never miss out. You can find Communicating Climate Change on LinkedIn too, and if you think the series would be of interest to friends or colleagues, why not point them in the right direction? Remember, each and every episode attempts to add to our toolkits to help us develop the smarts and the grit that we'll need for this sometimes thankless task. So be sure to stay tuned for more. For anything else, just head over to communicatingclimatechange.com. Until next time, take care.